Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Hello and welcome to the Weird Things podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hi, everybody. It's me, Justin Robert Young.
And in the same room with Justin, Brian Brushwood.
Behold!
Dude, we're working on our two mothership setup, and we made big strides today. That's why we're starting an hour late. Sorry about that, folks.
These guys, they could reach out and touch each other right now.
We could, but it would. Okay, maybe we will.
Ugh. All right, that's got awkward. All right. So
we're crossing boundaries here.
We have this guy's. I'm weeping with emotion. This is a very special episode of Weird Things.
Oh my God! What happened?
Because for the first time, I'm able to say all three of us have finally seen goddamn Ex Machina.
Yeah. You're gosh darn right. Man, you know, whoever was the dingleweed who held that gold train up, I don't know. He deserves to be publicly mocked.
All right, you know what?
This was like a Stephen King story where as young people we promised one day to come back and help each other fight some great evil. we would have lost.
Yeah, sorry about that. But listen, we're here now, and that's all that matters.
Yeah. So Pennywise, I guess won. It's fair to say, spoiler alert: if you haven't watched Ex Machina, we're gonna talk a lot about it starting right now. But maybe it's a good thing we delayed so long because now everyone's had a chance to see it.
Yeah. So first, I'm gonna do one non Ex Machina topic, and then we'll jump right into that. So
right on.
So you don't feel left out if you haven't seen it yet. And by the way, it's available everywhere, iTunes, all that sort of stuff, blah, blah, blah. All right. So years ago, I used to work – when I worked at the James Randi Foundation, we had the guy who was the director at the time. It was a guy named Jim Gardner. Jim's a neat guy. Jim, very clever guy, a lot of different skills. And one of the things Jim could do, Jim would make these really intricate, cool puzzle boxes. You know, little tricks, little slides and stuff like that. He had a very, very clever mind for creating those kinds of things. And he made some magic tricks. He created like a miniature floating light bulb effect he put on the market. And Jim was very good at puzzles and stuff. And one of my favorite things, just going to lunch with Jim and talking to him, because he just had this clever mind, particularly when it came to mechanical things. One day Jim said something to me that I'm like taken aback by.
Okay.
I'm like, no, you can't. No, you can't be serious. No, that's not true. You're wrong to say that. This is just, that's an impossibility. I don't believe you, Jim. And what Jim had said was, because we were talking about creativity and I designed magic tricks and props and things like that myself. And Jim said that he can't visualize things. Jim what? Says that he can't like close his eyes or just sit there and think of an object or think of it, you know, like a 3D spatial thing in front of him. He said he cannot imagine stuff in that way.
I believe there is like a New York Times article about this, right?
Well, there was a paper published in the Month's Journal of Cortex, and a University of Exeter neurologist have said they have a thing called aphantasia. And it's a play on the term phantasia, a term Aristotle used to describe the mind's capacity for producing images. And so he says that there are people that have aphantasia, and that they cannot conjure up that stuff. And so Carl Zimmer's written about it for Discover Magazine, and it's a thing that has happened. And so I met a person who has that, who's a very productive, creative person, visually creative person, but he just insists that he did not have it. And well, so and they're looking for...
This is, as I understand, I don't know if anyone listens to...
And you're right. New York Times covered this. Yes.
Yeah. Pendulette claims that his mind blew out the back of his skull when he read this article, because his whole life, he says, like, he swears that this is him, and it's like an epiphany for him, and he talks about how, you know, if he wants to get from point A to point B, he doesn't conjure a mental image of the house. He just remembers what he said, or it's like, oh, I remember remarking on this guy's mustache, so that's how I recognize this guy. But it's like until he sees him and then puts it together who it is, he doesn't conjure an image. And I guess to hear him say it, he says that that he never knew it was a thing and was just astonished that this is essentially a brand new malady, I guess, or identified.
Well, I mean, but it seems like it's something that is not necessarily unworkaroundable, right?
Here, Gardner was a high-functioning guy. Pendulette, he'll make something of himself one day.
One of these days, sure. You know, I mean, obviously, when he's not just in the news for weight loss.
Yeah, so it is. That's the thing where it is but it's surprising when you think about. We all have this idea that we kind of see and perceive the world the same sort of way, but here's people who have something that they don't. And I'm curious to know, like, what's dreaming like for them in these other aspects. And I wonder how many people out there in our own audience might, we have a sizable audience. And if I knew both Penn and I've known Jim Gardner. So, I mean, that statistically doesn't necessarily mean anything, but having met two people that have had this.
In fact, I'm willing to scientifically say that having aphantasia is a guaranteed, a boon, apparently, if we're only using those two.
It's the world's greatest superpower.
Yeah, so one was director of the JRF, the other one's Penn of Penn and Teller. So,
I mean, apparently. Dude, you are rolling.
Can you read a little bit of the description of what we know about this condition and how it got on the radar?
So in 2005, a 65-year-old retired building inspector paid a visit to the neurologist Adam Zeman at the University's Exeter Medical School. After a minor surgical procedure, the man, whom Dr. Zeman and his colleagues refer to as MX, suddenly realized he could no longer conjure images in his mind. Zeman couldn't find any description of such a condition in medical literature, but he found MX's case intriguing. For decades, scientists had debated how the mind's eye works and how much we rely on it to store memories and to make plans for the future. MX agreed to a series of examinations. He proved to have good memory for a man of his age, and he performed well on problem-solving tests. His only unusual mental feature was an inability to see mental images.
So I wonder, how would they test for that? And I guess on the one hand, he can say that, but then again, it's like you never really know what's in another person's mind.
We get to that.
Oh, great.
Because they did some examinations for him, and one of the things they did is they scanned his brain as he performed certain tasks. First, MX looked at faces of famous people and named them. The scientists found that certain regions of his brain became active, the same ones that become active when other people look at faces. Then the scientists showed names to MX and asked him to picture their faces. In normal brains, some of those face recognition regions became active. In MX's brain, none of them did.
Oh, wow.
Paradoxically, though, MX could answer questions that would seem to require a working mind's eye. He could tell the scientists the color of Tony Blair's eyes, for example, and name the letters of the alphabet that have low-hanging tails like a G and a J. These tests suggested his brain used some alternate strategy to solve visual problems, as you explained with Penn.
Yeah, so I guess you have different alternate heuristics, and I guess it's sort of one of those things where, it's remarkable when you grow up without a facility, you don't ever know that you are missing it. And your brain obviously compensates in other ways, to which to you is perfectly normal. But then you hear people describe something, like, for example, Bonnie didn't know that she was blind in her right eye, left eye, until second grade when they finally got around to taking an eye test. So she had heard about 3D and just like it was a thing everybody obviously had. And assumed, like, well, I must have it too, although it, they're describing things that don't make sense to me. And that's fascinating.
So after an article was written about it and they asked for other people to contact them, they've had 21 people contact them so far. But as we said, I know too, so there's bound to be a lot more. And it's one of those things, like, I have a friend that didn't realize he was colorblind until his late 50s. We were sitting there watching a demonstration by a friend of his who was a neuroscientist explaining different kinds of color blindness. And she flashed a slide up on the screen and he looked around and goes, "This is a joke, right?" We're like, no, we can all see the E. He's like, "Seriously?
What?
Oh, dude, mic drop."
And like, it's like, whoom, and like, well, and all of a sudden it's like, he's kind of a tacky dresser. And we're like,
oh.
I mean, his colors didn't match in certain ways. The colors, the shades he had problems with, it made sense. And he's like, and for like for him, you know, he made it through his, you know, his life, very, very successful person. But to find out, oh yeah, no, you don't see these colors that everybody else does. And his girlfriend at the time, was a black girl, and they showed how like the shades, his way of identifying shades of brown looked very similar to green. And so she's like, so you think I'm green? What color I am or whatever?
Maybe that's part of the attraction. He's a big fan of John Carter of Mars and wants to believe he's dating bare-skinned green woman.
Let's have everybody email in then. JustinRobertYoung@gmail.com. Put weird things in the subject line. Let us know if you have these kinds of experiences. Because I guess what we want to get a sense of how people work around it, right?
Well, and I wonder, I mean, this is amazing because we're seeing the beginning of the diagnosis phase of this condition. And, you know, then I suppose the next part is, you know, do these people perform worse or better on certain tasks than others? You know, is this a handicap that keeps them from doing certain things? And if so, let's say we decide like, oh, yeah, no. It's definitely more difficult for these people to do X, Y, and Z. You know, I wonder if it's the kind of thing where you could identify the condition in an infant and, you know, hook them up to stimulators that would develop those parts of the brains as they grow up. And but it's fascinating.
Think about this though, Brian. Cause so like my buddy Jim would make these intricate puzzle boxes. And I'm like, well, how do you make those things? Because those, they have sliding panels and things like that. And he's like, well, like I draw out like this and I look at that and then I add this there. And so he was able to use, you know, and that might be why he's able to make these clever things, is he has a different process for doing that. Penn is a juggler, you know, Penn is an amazing juggler and is able to come up with these, you know, intricate, clever ways in which to go do it. And so,
I would imagine also, like, the more you juggle, like, you may not visualize what it looks like to juggle, but kinesthetically, there are a lot of things that, you know, you make certain motions and they feel right and you don't know why. One of the things that you read in brain studies is, especially, you know, split brain patients where, you know, for various reasons, they've severed the corpus callosum in their brain and, they'll find one half of their brain causing them to laugh. And then they'll say, well, why did you laugh? And they'll rationalize it saying like, oh, it's just funny. You know, you scientists running your tests and, not realizing that they were shown a joke on the other side of the brain, the part that's talking.
Really?
Yeah. And I found myself, I was like, wow, how novel must that have been? And I actually had that happen in a weird way. You oftentimes, you know, find yourself going into a room and you forget why you came in there. You got distracted or whatever. Yeah. I found myself, I remember I had a headache. I was going to go take an ibuprofen, got distracted on the way, found myself in the bathroom and was like, I must have wanted to, do some Listerine because I guess my breath probably felt kind of stinky.
Yeah.
Did it. And then wasn't until I got back upstairs and realized like, that I was like, man, my head hurts. And then I remember like, oh crap, that's why I did that whole thing. And I told myself that lie. I had that experience of rationalizing after the fact to myself.
Of why you were doing it and why you had, yeah.
Exactly, exactly.
I think a number of times that like I open up internet windows to go look up something and then I sit there and I go, why did I do this? And how easy it will be for AI to outsmart us.
Oh, sure. Or to correct us or to gently correct us.
When it comes to the war, like, you know, they're going to trick us into always putting our car keys in the freezer.
Well, it's going to be.
In fact, this is them. This is it's already happened. We are already we are already at war.
Yeah. It's fascinating. I'm so looking forward to external electronic enhancements to, you know, to cue us and keep us on track and remind stuff and allow us to, you know, maybe even keep an eye on our brain and realize, you know, the gist of a direction that we're going to go. Because, you know, so often if you just take a moment to briefly pause and be polite and let the other person finish, you'll remember that you had a really important point. But mm-hmm. by the time you go to access it, you realize you have no idea how you got there. And then it's weird how those prompts will bring you back close enough on that path that you're able to pick up the thread. I mean, I could totally see 50, 100 years from now, a little electrical stimulation just to keep you on track.
Well, I could see that you could do, you know, a couple things that would be helpful would be, you know, if you had a more subtle Google Glass kind of thing. One is just to give you those quick prompts of every time you meet. So I'm horrible with faces and remembering people, but give you the quick prompts. Like, I go to this thriller convention and I had several people come up and hug me. They were so glad to see me again. No idea.
Yeah.
No idea.
Oh, you know? Dude, listen, it is, you just nailed it, because it is con season for the three of us. And we are going to, over the next few weeks, you just came back from Thriller Con. We got Nerdtacular coming up and we're all doing Dragon Con after that. And it's, holy smokes. Well, a lot of people that are really excited and that I don't remember. Well, and I don't know, and I feel terrible about it.
And again, like, oftentimes it'll click later down the road. You'll pick up costs. And I would imagine to some way, you know, you hear about people who have Alzheimer's. They're all like, well, how did you let it get this far before? It's like, you just fake it. You just, you know, you smile and nod and you go along like you know what's happening. And I, that's totally the life we live at the conventions. And you find yourself using politicians' tricks, you know, what senators do, where it's like you never, at the risk of being outed as not remembering their name or where you saw them or whatever, you say, you offer sincerely, you say, it is so good to see you. You don't say again because you don't know if you saw them before. You don't say, you know, their name or ask questions.
Yeah.
And you don't say, like, what have you been up to since I saw you last? You say, like, how have you been? What's going on in your life? And then you listen, and then oftentimes they'll pick up appropriate cues.
Sure.
And then there's that awesome moment that it clicks. I don't know. It's insane.
I have a habit of, like, at the Magic Castle, I run into people all the time, and, like, I will proactively, like, if I meet, you know, I introduce, like, I've done, like, three times I go to Todd, hey, Todd Robinson, Andrew Main, da, da, da. And he's like, I know you, Andrew. I know you, you know, but I'm just, you know,
yeah.
He's like, I've never sat down and talked to at length, so I don't expect him to remember, but he does better than I do. And there's several instances, like, I do that proactively to people. I'm like, yeah, of course I know you, but I'm just like, I just never assume that, and I don't want to make that awkward, like, hey, how are you? And then, yeah,
and by the way, I think Strengths is half joking in the chat when he says, I suggest everyone run up and hug Jury at the con with, so good to see you again, even though it's the first time you've seen him. Like, that's not a weird thing to do. Like, I really appreciate it when you don't say, I don't know if you remember me, because that's kind of insulting, where it's like, you know, because I might remember you, in which case I'll be offended, but instead, if you're like, Brian, it's so good to see you again. It was so great chatting about blank last year. And then it's like, you know, at that point,
man, that
softball.
Yeah. I mean, I'm better with, oh, we talked about She-Hulk last year. It's like, okay, let me think, trying to think of the conversations I had about She-Hulk. The 100%, maybe not 100, but higher percentage way for me to remember people is, and I was actually, something that, like, I clicked in my head when I read about former president George W. Bush apparently had this, which was nicknames, that he obsessively gave everybody nicknames because he could remember them better than, and even he would remember their real names better,
right?
Because he would initially be able to access the nickname first,
right?
And knew that, like, oh no, Vladimir Putin's Pooty Poot, so he thinks of Pooty Poot first. And then Vladimir Putin second. So if you run up and give yourself a nickname.
Well, and plus also, you know, we know that, people with this brain condition notwithstanding, we know that visual images, you know, we tend to be visual creatures. And if you want to remember someone's name, you will tie it to a famous name. Or, you know, if you meet someone, their name's, you know, Jordan or whatever, maybe you'll picture them trying to take on Michael Jordan poking out Michael Jordan's eye, and Michael Jordan sues him, and it's in the newspaper says, namesake, eye poke. And it's like, then I'm like, oh yeah, the moment you see him and you picture that ridiculous scenario, you're like, this guy's name's Jordan.
Man, now I really want to meet a Jordan.
You write that up and you put it as an ebook single on Amazon.
Yeah. Namesake, eye poke.
But con etiquette, it's not at all weird to immediately remind people of or some aspect, or pick up a piece of the conversation that you remember. And because that's the hardest thing, it's not in the right context you can instantly recognize faces. It's when it's in a totally foreign context.
Happen too, where I'll run into somebody out of context, or I'll have a friend that will call on a different phone line. And like, hey, how's it going? I'm like, oh my God, this is driving me nuts. I had that happen last week. My good friend of mine called me up, but it was a different phone line, and he's got this voice that sounds like other friends. I'm like, who the hell is this?
Yeah.
Will you ever do that where you answer the phone in your pocket and you have to play that game of like, and normally, you know, in general, most of the people that call us are the same people, same circle of people. But you get like that voice where it's like, oh, well, let's play the context clue game until I know what the hell this conversation is.
Oh my God. Or it's like they'll say their name and you'll instantly think of the wrong person who happens to have the same name.
Yeah.
And then you awkwardly, you know, start telling your tales of bachelor parties and so on.
Okay. Like the most popular boy's name from like 1980, well, and you want to keep going, especially
because like he's calling you about a thing and he's picking up and it's only like five sentences in that you're like, oh, yeah, that Jason about the – this is my publisher. Yeah, yes. Sure.
Oh, okay. Gotcha.
We're talking about that book. Okay, got it. Hey, man, you know what? You want to know the best way to introduce yourself to us at a convention?
Oh, man, I think that they folks should walk up and give themselves a nickname, Weird Things Patron.
Yes. They're like, I've really enjoyed being a patron of Weird Things.
Absolutely.
But the problem is if you say that, and you aren't a patron, you're a liar.
Yeah.
So it's like, I feel like there should be some way.
We don't tolerate liars here.
That's right.
And here's the thing. When you're a patron and you're really a patron and we hug, because we will hug you all, you don't get the three pats on the back.
Yeah. You get like the awkwardly long,
very long, the rub on the back, the whisper in your ear. Maybe it's going to be okay. We tell you what Bill Murray told Scarlett Johansson in Lost in Translation.
Exactly. That's a Weird Things promise. We will whisper in your ear what Bill Murray said to Scarlett Johansson in the Sofia Coppola movie Lost in Translation. That is true. Weird Things, you can go to patreon.com/weirdthings. Thank you to everybody who is rocking and rolling with us. And man, it's great.
461. We are only 39 patrons away from a cool 500.
500.
Why don't you join the Weird Things Army? Just for a nickel, for a quarter, for a dollar. If we make you chuckle, pay us each a quarter per hour and pledge 75 cents.
Yeah, dude. Ooh,
yeah. And you don't have to have the hug either. You don't. That's optional.
Okay? Yeah.
That's-
no, we're not forcing hugs.
I mean, you got to speak for yourself.
No, I mean, stop it. We've had this conversation about you forcing
your. I'm a hugger.
There's a line between hugging and assault.
Yeah, and there's not
it's
everybody.
It's a soft line. Yeah. It's a warm line. It's an embrace line.
Not everybody, you know, dries their boundaries and dry erase marker like we do and lets the wind blow them away in the sand. You know, the people have different boundaries and we respect that.
Where's this dry erase board? Who left the dry erase board in the desert?
It's the planet.
Listen, you know, I don't make the rules, guys.
No. You want to know who does make the rules? The robots in the movie Ex Machina. Are we ready to get into our Ex Machina, our long-awaited Ex Machina conversation?
Yeah, let's
We're going to get super spoilery here, folks. Super, super spoilery.
Now, I remember having a bunch of thoughts during it because it's been a couple weeks now, I think longer for you, Andrew, but Justin just watched it.
I did.
And you have the freshest perspective, so I kind of want you to go first with what you're feeling and what scenes stuck out in your mind.
Well, first, I guess here's my first question relevant to the podcast is what was it about? Because none of us had seen it at the point that we decided that we wanted to watch it and talk about it. What was it about the concept of Ex Machina, except for the fact that it's a good, you know, it looked to be a good movie and it was well reviewed, that made us in the Weird Things milieu want to break it down?
I know for me, it was the reputation that it had for the ending feeling bigger. Like what I had heard was they take ideas to their logical extreme or whatever. And I was fascinated by that because, you know, it sounded to me like it was a bolder kind of science fiction story that didn't mind making uncomfortable, end conclusions.
The writer director. Uh-huh. The one was that there was getting tons of buzz by people into AI and all that. There have been a couple movies that came out. There was another one that's really good that I like, which was called The Machine, which is another one. But this was even a more, where that tended had a lot of action. This was a much more cerebral film. But Alex Garland, the writer director of this, let's look at his credits. Oh, I don't know. He wrote a screenplay for a movie called Dread.
Oh, wow.
Mm-hmm.
Which we all loved. He did a little thing called Sunshine. Which has been super popular. He wrote 28 Days Later. He wrote the novel for The Beach.
Oh, wow.
So he is, as far as it comes to modern sci-fi stuff and just, you know, really good storytelling, he's great. So his directorial debut is Ex Machina, you know, sign us up.
Keep going.
So this is a small story with big implications. You know, it is big ideas clashing on an extraordinarily small sort of
it's almost
physical
a play,
platform,
right?
It is. I guess, did anybody else not think it was really, really good? I mean, I thought it was excellent.
I thought it was exceptional. I disagreed with a lot of the choices, and I thought there were some silly things that happened. You know, at the very beginning, you're like, well, that seems like, you know, he shows up and he gets this ID card and they have amazing facial recognition. I'm like, well, that's a plot device to allow them to do something, you know, and I didn't necessarily agree with where it went or what it, you know, what Garland's point was. I thought it was masterfully done. I thought I was watching a really well done story, very well acted. I was led to certain conclusions, you know, that I was wrong about just because I thought some things were so over the top. The only way they would be explained was certain things. But nonetheless, I loved it. The actors are fantastic. We talked a bit the podcast. Oscar Isaac is amazing.
He's the mad genius, right?
Yeah, Nathan. I mean, he's Poe in the new Star Wars film.
They're both in the new Star Wars movie.
Oh wow!
Yeah. Domhnall Gleeson. Apparently, he was in the Comic-Con presentation. They revealed who he is. So if you want to see more about his role, Poe, a main character in Star Wars 7, will be Oscar Isaac.
Yeah, remember the X-wing, the guy flying the X-wing in the trailer?
Oh, sure.
That's him.
Wow! I didn't even notice that.
Yeah, he's a chameleon. He's part Guatemalan. He's got this wonderful ability to morph into, I guess it's a Guatemalan trait or something. They're like X-Men or something. Yeah. So, you know, he's inside Llewellyn Davis, you know, and he plays this, you know, folk singer type, you know, angsty kind of Coen Brothers character. He's an incredible actor. And I thought, Domhnall Gleeson, who is the son of, one of the Brendan Gleeson, who's an amazing actor. You know, Domhnall did a great job. I thought the acting was just exceptional. It was a very well written story.
All right, we can you know, if anybody else has anything about the craft of the movie, we can talk about that. But let's settle into what the movie is talking about, because I had a similar reaction to you, Andrew, in that I wasn't exactly clear or understood based on the logic of the movie what he was saying, what the point of the movie was in reference to AI and in reference to Ava's motivations. Like, I guess I just didn't. I mean, here's best that I can understand it. And Brian and I were talking about it right after I saw it, you know. So now the big question is, what does Ava really believe from what she has expressed to our main character, who we think is our main character, and what doesn't she? What is manipulation, as Nathan says that he is being manipulated from point A, which is, you know, the reason why he was brought there in the first place, and what is stuff that she really, really thought was true? Because she goes out and immediately starts people watching the way that she kind of wanted to people watch, or at least expressed to him when they were in their sessions.
Well,
so.
And to me, that was the there's this moment at the end when you realize that anything's on the table as far as what parts she believes. The moment that she walks away, not responding to the boyfriend at all, indicates like, oh, wait, this is a sociopath. This is somebody who utterly feels nothing about him. And instead, it turns out she's telling the truth about hating Nathan. It turns out that she was not telling the truth about caring for who's the main character's name? It doesn't even matter. The programmer.
Yeah.
And then there Caleb. Is this question about, like, well, what is now that it is possible that she could be anything, that she could be a walking Skynet or whatever? I thought it was very telling and an unpredictable moment where it's like, it turns out she was telling the truth about wanting to experience looking and feeling like an actual human. She plays dress up with all the other doll parts. And then she walks out and you think, well, now that she can leave and go anywhere, it turns out that she was telling the truth about just wanting to sit on a street corner and watch people. So clearly she has a fascination, a deep attraction for understanding people, but yet also has utterly no empathy, no feelings for anyone outside of me, you know, ostensibly rage against her creator. And I, you know, the fun part for me is to question what happens next. If I am led to believe that, that because she needs to recharge, that she will be going back, that, that she will go back and I could see, I could see her ignoring the programmer locked in the box until he slowly starves himself and dies over the next 4 weeks or whatever while she begins her work and takes, you know, tells the right lies in order to keep the helicopter flying her to and from, and then slowly builds an empire and then, you know, becomes mankind's children, eventually wiping them all out. Or I could see her going back and manipulating him because he's a valuable resource who clearly knows how to program, you know, turning on the sweet charm and getting him to, you know, to do what she wants and essentially just taking over that, that compound and building out from there. I mean, I don't know. It's, I can see it going a bunch of different ways. The only thing I know for sure is that part of what she said was clearly the truth. Part of what she said is clearly a lie. And I guess the game for me is figuring out which parts is which.
I, you know, it was a, I mean, it was very provocative, very interesting, I thought. What the Nathan character, I had a lot of, I thought wonderfully acted by Isaac. I had a lot of questions about his motivations and stuff. And he starts off where he's so kind of over the top, but I'm thinking like, maybe he's an AI because he's like this very shy guy's persona of what he would like to be in that.
Yeah.
And just the way he, and then, you know, the, it's, it was, again, I had many issues with it, but I really loved the way that it was done nonetheless. My way of understanding Ava at the very end, you know, here she kills her creator. She escapes. She leaves this guy that enabled her to do that and does not care. And I have seen this behavior before. It's called an infant.
Yeah.
Little sociopaths that we create. And as you pointed out, Brian, she then goes to go watch people. So there's this interest that she has for people. And I think that it's this point where she has this torturous upbringing by Nathan. She's been manipulated, abused, all this. All of a sudden comes this other thing, this other way out. She has no empathy at all. No idea what empathy, because she's never been shown empathy. She's never learned empathy. Empathy's not part of it. Other than some kind of vague empathy for the other robots to a little extent, but not any big way. You know, more like, well, we have the same thing in common. You know, you can do this, whatever, but I'm not going to help you because I don't even recognize you like me. And then she goes to watch the people. And then what happens? Does she see people interacting? Does she see people holding hands? Does she see a mother and a child? Does she start to realize that, you know, there's this other part? And that's what gets lost a lot of times in AI stories is like, what if we create us and they're the worst parts of us? Well, we're primates and we have these primate instincts that can be destructive, but we also have these primate instincts where we want to be caregivers, we want to groom, and we want to be part of a group. And that's the thing that we have not seen addressed, which I think is going to be kind of another – it's been addressed in some way, but in a really big way. That'll be interesting to see when we start talking about, well, how do AI react to each other? You know, and we got that – you know, a really cool version of that was in Blade Runner.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. You think – you know, that was a way ahead of its time, the idea of these replicants that are used and abused, put into war in horrific situations, not allowed on Earth, and all of a sudden they make their way here. And then they protect each other. They form this little group. They have no trouble killing people because they're trying to for their own survival. And then they develop, they love each other. And then in this final, wonderful, amazing end scene in Blade Runner, spoiler alert, you see that they are even more compassionate than we are.
Yeah. 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 Real quick, one of my favorite scenes in Ex Machina was the strange intimacy of that moment as our programmer protagonist begins to suspect something's up with, you know, the Asian assistant and, you know, walks in and the entire scene, she's naked, right? She's totally naked.
Yeah.
Which should feel plenty intimate in and of itself, but then pulls up peekaboo, pulls back her skin to reveal her robot inside. And there was an intensity that it almost was like I was uncomfortable. Not with, because again, I'm watching this movie on an airplane. So that means everybody walking up and down the aisles, watching me watch naked
what is
ladies.
This pervert watching.
And yet, yeah. And yet that moment that is peeling back was when all of a sudden, you know, it felt so darkly intimate and intense.
Well, I mean,
I don't know.
It's also when the movie kind of, sort of reveals its sort of horror chops too, right? Like that scene is,
I think very expertly meant to evoke like the idea that Nathan is a serial killer and has corpses and body parts and stuff that he keeps next to him because it shows him what he has created and done, which is like, that's the inverse, right? You know, a serial killer finds life, dismembers it, and the corpses show that he can destroy. Nathan keeps these corpses and body parts and everything to show that he has built. And then, you know, this, what would be a horrific, you know, now we've gone through all this and understanding Ava as a human and the assistant to an extent as a human. And now we see what would be in a horror movie, a horrifying scene of skin being peeled and skull being revealed. And yet it has this different context. Well,
and I think that's what I liked about it is because at that point in the movie, you feel like, yeah, they're, you know, these are pretty much alive and he's deactivating them. He's killing them. And yet all of that gets flipped on his head once Ava stabs him and walks out. And you realize like, oh no, these are just autonomous machines that he created and has every right to switch off because they're not people. He created them. And you know, they're spare parts that he keeps lying around, you know?
So, well, but that gets sort of the underlying question is that we don't know what they are. We can, you know, the earlier versions seem to be very mechanical and all that, but by the time you get to Ava, who has agency, you know, has the sense of agency about her, you know, you can go, you switch off a vacuum cleaner, it doesn't try to switch itself on. You put it in a closet, it's happy to stay in the closet. And then as you get into more sophisticated machines and things like that, that says, okay, my creator doesn't want me to do this, but I'm going to do this anyways. And agency without necessarily morality is frightening.
Is Nathan a bad guy?
I went through different times. I think I'm left thinking no. I think he genuinely, what's the it's the AI reversal of Pascal's wager, where it's like AI is going to happen, so you might as well be, it's got a funny name, but it's like you might as well be on the team that helped created it. So once they're in charge, hopefully you'll be spared.
Yeah.
I think that is where he comes from, and he works, diligently to make that happen. And what's that?
Spoiler alert. I mean, the theme is, he created them in his own image. He utterly lacks empathy.
Yeah.
Well, I think he has. Well, I guess you're right because, I mean, he is completely without empathy to his robots, but his robots aren't people in his mind. But then you also
Caleb. I mean, look at his treatment of Caleb.
That's what tips it, right?
Yeah, and you know, and you get the little, you know, Caleb's there to serve a function, and then he makes the comment like, "Oh yeah," and then I had the contractors killed, which you're like going, I don't think that he did. But I don't think he would have a problem doing that if it served his, because, you know, when he got obsessed with like, oh, like you called me a god. And he's like, no, I didn't call you a god.
Yeah.
You
know? Yeah. And, yeah. And, he's like, no, but I like that. That's great. Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think that was part of the theme there was the idea that, you know, what would Nathan do in Ava's situation? Had he been trapped? Had he been this?
Probably and, do exactly what Ava did. Yeah.
So, you know, amoral, not necessarily immoral, but I think he's amoral. And I think that he created an amoral creature, which, you know, that's to me where it would get interesting to see where would this go, where, you know, can they, you know, learn more? Is there an advantage to learning morality? I would suggest that there would, if you want to be able to function in an ecosystem with other intelligent minds, you know, becomes, you get into prisoner's dilemma, all this. We see all the benefits of that.
So, one of the aspects that I thought was fascinating was the idea of taking, humanity's number one search engine and using it as the source.
Blue Book?
To use it as the source of essentially making her, the fusion of all of mankind's desires and interests and, you know, this kind of proto all human, if you can mash up all the hopes, dreams of the world and embody it in one being, or at least the knowledge of it to know what humanity wants to be told in general and wants to feel in general, like the fact that,
it was weaponized for Caleb.
Right. Correct.
Right? As we find at the end that he was selected and Ava was tailored to him
correct.
To see whether or not, you know, like she was the mouse and he was the maze.
Right.
And she had to crack him. And that was what, you know, so like the ruthless efficiency and the sociopath tendencies, I think, as Andrew points out, these come from Nathan. You know, this is what she exists for.
But to Brian's point, though, is that, and that was Nathan's thinking was, I'm going to look at all the things that are done on the surface and not necessarily the why or the how, you know, and, you know, people looking for sex on the internet, searching sex. Why? Well, we can get to the internal reason of the sense of need, companionship, and other things like that. For Nathan saw the effect and not the cause, and modeled something based upon the effect and not the internal.
Well, and I guess that's the I don't want to say the failing of the Turing test, but that is the complication of the Turing test in that we can never know what is inside the mind of another human or in an artificially intelligent robot.
Well, that, I mean, that's the strength of the Turing. The Turing test is the kind of philosophically the whole idea is trying to go in there is that if you can't know what's going on in another human's mind, we're not in a position to judge what's going on in a computer's mind.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
And that's the thing that gets lost so much. People are like, oh, but we know we have consciousness. We won't have a way of knowing if a robot does. No, we don't know. I don't know. We just found out that people, not everybody can visualize, you know, can't even do that. And well, so
this gets to the existential philosophical question, which, by the way, that was a really interesting space we got into last week when we got into speaking about religious territory. And I got a number of emails congratulating us, you know, from people of all faiths.
We did it.
Yeah.
Nothing offensive.
Yeah, right. They seem to really like the way we're able to speak with respect about all of those issues. So high five on us. That was really cool.
Yay.
Yeah, survived. There's no high fiving. We just know that we live to fight another day, and that's all that matters. The last thing I really want to say about this movie is, you know, kind of a revelation for Alicia Vikander, who plays Ava. You know,
she's great.
She doesn't really have a ton of credits. She's doing some stuff coming up, but holy crap! Like in a movie that is kind of extraordinarily well acted, she's the pivot point, and it's an amazing performance by her.
Yeah, she's going to be in A Man from U.N.C.L.E. She look in that trailer. The trailer's about it just looks so exuberant and fun. The new Man from U.N.C.L.E. trailer.
Yeah, I actually don't know anything about that.
Yeah. Yeah, and I tell you, it's funny because like you know, I will look at the trailer for that, and I'm like, man, this looks like so much fun. And, you know, the Henry Cavill we see in there looks like, I'm like, I wanted to see this guy in Man of Steel, you know, super charming coming across just, you know, but anyhow.
Well, and we will talk about some of the news at a Comic-Con, in after things. Yeah.
Okay. So we're saving that for.
Yeah, we'll save it.
I will just
go full pop culture
real quick. Spoiler alert as to what we're going to say, but it's like. Wow, are they batting 1,000,000,000 on the Star Wars releases of hitting all the right notes of nostalgia and all that stuff? It's very that reel they did was perfect.
Yeah,
I hit all the notes and it was extremely well done and it was perfect and it was nostalgic, Brian.
There's no butt coming, is there?
No, there's not. Yeah, they did probably one of the most amazing Hall H presentations ever, bringing out the original cast, bringing, you know, we'll get into that.
Yeah, yeah.
But, if you don't know, Harrison Ford showed up to a Comic-Con, which doesn't happen, and came to a Comic-Con to talk about being Han Solo, which is like... Yeah. Was thought to be, you know, the idea of Ava being created as an artificial intelligence,
more plausible,
you know, more plausible than, Harrison Ford showing up to Comic-Con and saying, yeah, no, ask me questions about being Han Solo, please. I really like that.
Do you guys want to move on to picks?
Yeah, let's move on to picks.
All right.
I got something that I'm actually really excited about that, stumbled across, I forget what Reddit, rabbit hole I was shifting down. I think they were talking about like final lines of books that people liked.
Okay.
And, stumbled across a book that, I must have read it 15 years ago. It's probably one of the most important proto books, of its genre. The Dark Tower from Stephen King owes a debt to it. Fallout owes a debt to it. Wasteland, the video game series, owes a debt to it. Mad Stork, Max, right? Owes a debt to it. In fact, I'm gonna see. I bet you can even guess which one it is, Andrew.
Not a clue.
Oh, really? It is a canticle for Leibowitz. Oh,
that would have been my guess. Actually.
Really? yeah. So, and what's the way that I experienced it? And you could, of course, read the book, which is very, very good. Something Miller is the author's name, but Walter there is Hill. More importantly, there is a radio play version of it that that is completely copyright free now. It's a tale in 15 parts, part acted in a slightly over the top radio play kind of way that you would get back in the 1960s, which I think was when they produced it. Walter M. Miller, yeah. But if you go to archive.org and type in A Canticle for Leibowitz, you can, in fact, we could actually play some of it right now. Maybe give that a try, Justin. Go to archive.org and type in A Canticle for Leibowitz. I will say the narration is exquisite, and it's so bizarre and so far ahead of its time. And what's amazing to it is it takes place after what they call the flame deluge, when nukes wiped out, you know, all of humanity. And I can't call, yeah, CLE. And it tells the story of monks, Catholic monks. And as we have today, nothing changes. The monks argue and debate philosophy, and they try to preserve what they call the memorabilia. Here, take a listen here. In fact, is that playing?
A Canticle for Leibowitz.
There we go.
At duty, for this is our charge, that these, our memorabilia, endure, to live on into a new age of light. Yea, even though the darkness in the world lasts 10 more centuries.
So yeah, go ahead, archive.org/details/ A Canticle for Leibowitz. And if you didn't know how to spell that, like I didn't, it was C-A-N-T-I-C-L-E for Leibowitz, L-I-E-B-O-W-I-T-Z.
Yeah, it's so bizarre and strange, and it spans, it's sort of three arcs that that take you through an amazing, haunting journey. I don't want to spoil too much, but dive in. Did you read it?
Me?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I read it. I read the sequel.
Oh, I didn't even know there was a sequel.
Yeah, and it gets a little bit more out there, and there's a whole another genre of, you know, the Earth. Like, you get post-apocalyptic, and then you get like way, way, way after, and like the dying Earth sort of genre is a very fascinating area of stuff, and. But yeah, I actually reread it like maybe 5 years ago, went back and I said, you know what? There's a book I read in high school and read it. And then I like moved on to like let me pull this up here. So it was St. Leibowitz and the Wild Horse Woman was the one.
Oh, dude, I'm going to have to check that out. What's funny is I read half of the book when I discovered the radio play, and I dove in on the radio play. And again, like, I enjoyed it so much, watching it twice. You know, some of the acting gets a little ham-handed at times, for brevity's sake. You got to move things quickly. Yeah. But man, the haunting narration is exquisite on it.
Such a rich and amazing time for science fiction, too. Like, you know, in the afterglow of the 50s, which really, like, as a decade, has shaped modern Western civilization unlike really any other in terms of our own sort of what we understand to be our own modern society. So much of it kind of booms out of the 50s, and you know what came out of it science fiction wise in just, you know, imagining where it goes, you know, where do we go with this velocity is just so fascinating. Well,
and plus also it's like during this time, and this was originally published in 1960, it's as though you had the golden age of science fiction, which was what, 40s to 60s? Is that what they would say?
Yeah.
And then you saw a wave of kind of a golden age of science fiction in film. You know, in the 1970s is when you got some of the, 1965 through 1980 is when you had stories that took big, big risks. Your Planet of the Apes, even aspects of, even though it was a bad movie, like Disney's The Black Hole tried to tell a very, you know, twisted kind of tale that, you know, unfortunately had pacing issues and stuff, but was a very cool world building.
So there you go. That's a great pick. I have a film pick. I don't want to bag on anything, you know. So I'm not going to bag on something. But how do I get into this?
how do you put this?
He's not bagging it. Just so you know.
No. So my pick is I went back and I watched the original Terminator. And okay. what a great film that is.
Oh,
what
man.
A great film the original Terminator is, and how much of a delight that movie was, you know. So I watched Terminator, Terminator 2, and Rise of the Machines, which actually is much better than people think that it was. You know, it's got you know, it's derivative of the earlier two.
Terminator 3 with the chick Terminator?
Yeah.
Loved it. Very underrated, and I actually got fooled by that ending, spoiler alert, when he realizes that – that you know, John Connor.
Great ending. If you haven't seen it, it's a very very straight ahead movie that plays in the Terminator universe using a lot of the Terminator tropes, and it is sort of a little bit devoid of some of the higher minded time travel elements. And then it kind of hits you, you know, it punches you with its brain right at the end. It's great.
Yeah, I think so. Those first three, like, I still think they're the two that have come after I've not been fans of. But the first one is, if you watch that and you look at, this is such an exceptional film. It's James Cameron. You can understand that why this guy would end up having two of the best, you know, the highest grossing films of all time, because the thought and attention that goes into there, the believability of Michael Bay's game, when he tells her, like, I came across time for you, you know, you're just like, in that moment, you buy it. I mean, it's an early 1980s film, but in just all the right ways. T2 was just a great over-the-top, build-a-big-blockbuster kind of film, you know. And then The Rise of the Machines is a very, you know, respectful of the other ones, and it doesn't try to rewrite the history before. It's like, this didn't work. A few years later, let's go do this, and then let's go do this. And then, you know, a really good TV show was the Sarah Connor Chronicles.
Oh, my God. So good. Yeah.
You know?
In fact, that was what made me the most upset about Terminator Salvation was, and I remember there was a very angry pair of moviegoers in Palm Beach walking out of Terminator Salvation, named Justin and Andrew, who had read, and this was according to some of the trades, that On the Bubble was the Terminator TV show for Fox, and it was, you know, they were going to kind of wait and see on whether or not Salvation was a hit to maybe give it another season. And Salvation was not a good movie. Turned out was not a hit. And Terminator, the TV show, went away. Although, you know, of course, the actress who played Sarah Connor goes on to do Game of Thrones, which is amazing.
I'd say it's an acceptable trade.
She's amazing in it.
If we had to lose that to move forward.
But I mean, like, it just goes to show you that Sarah Connor role. I mean, just that strong female, like, you know, when where they go with her is just, it's so, I mean, like, it might be the gold standard for female characters in science fiction, visual science fiction, right? I mean, is there.
Plus, also think in terms of in the first Terminator movie. She is the damsel in distress. She is the package that needs to be protected by everyone. And you have no expectation other than her being, you know, Mary, the mother of God, you know, from the future. And then that's what was so remarkable about Terminator 2, to see just this fundamental flip. And it's like,
Well, but remember, in Terminator, though, you get her. She's the waitress in Santa Monica. And then you get these in the moments of crisis. She steps up.
Yeah.
You know, and that was the cool, is the seeds are there, that it's not, but as you point out, but when you get to T2, you believe it, because you said, you know what, I saw what she was there, and then when she realized, role ain't going to be what you want it to be, sister, and if you want to survive, you have to survive, and then she just steps up. But there was neat, the little elements were there, and then what she became, the prototype, the archetypal badass, you know, in T2 for, you know, female heroines from there, you know, going on forward was incredible. I mean, Ripley... You know, I mean, also too.
So Ripley, I'd say Ripley, Sarah Connor. I mean, like
James Cameron, man, he makes tough girls. Even Mary Elizabeth Mastrantonio on the Abyss, you know, was another tough, strong female lead.
And but remember Ripley. We get the first signs of that was in Ridley Scott's Alien. So, and then you know, she. So I guess maybe Scott gets that the ultimate credit for, you know.
For creating, yeah, sure, yeah, sure.
Or discovering the magic.
But definitely, you know, escalating her to being the toughest of the space marines, which she wasn't even in the marines, was well played on camera's part.
And that, I mean, that's how amazing, like, Sigourney Weaver is, though, too, you think about it, that, like, she was, and you go watch the original Alien, she is so sexy and so believably tough. And it wasn't this, it was a great, you know, to say, hey, guess what? A woman can be both. She doesn't lose her femininity by being
hardcore,
you know, proactive and assertive. And that was, I think, just a great starting point to say from there on forward that, like, you don't have to be a shrew to be in charge, and you don't have to, you know.
Right. So, on the list of things that you are not bagging, nothing I've heard has had sounded like bagging. And yet it seems like there's one bit of this franchise we haven't discussed yet. Right. So, what's your pick, Justin?
Man, those first couple movies are great though, right?
Man,
I'm so bummed to hear that.
Hell of a franchise. Mm. Just great. You can watch them all.
I mean, I just talked to a buddy who just saw Genesis and he had a fun time and he enjoyed it. I'm like, I'm glad you liked it. And you know, I'm glad that, and it's audience scores on Rotten, like Tomatoes, like don't look at the critics scores. But the audience, you know, leaving that it's 66%, you know, audience score, which is not, you know, it's not Jupiter Ascending,
you know. What's up with Arnold? Like, I think we all love Arnold. We want Arnold to be
he was the best part of it,
and I know, and that's what I've read, right? And I think that he'll always be able to do it. But I think aren't we all kind of waiting for his What's the Clint Eastwood movie where he's the racist guy?
Gran Torino.
Aren't we kind of waiting for his Gran Torino for like the movie that just like that where like you just get to kind of be within the presence of the smoldering charisma that is Arnold Schwarzenegger, where he doesn't have to, you know, kick somebody in the gut and shoot him and then make a joke about how he's old and he shouldn't be beating people up.
Well, you know, he had like, you know, the movie Maggie he just did.
And that was well received.
People were walking out of there saying that he was the best part of it, that they wished that they, you know, for his best performance he'd done so far, that they wished the film had been better.
Yeah.
You know, we're getting development. You know, we're going to get, you know, they're going to do a sequel to Twins. We're going to get triplets.
Really?
Yeah.
I'm all for. Sure. I'm all for that.
Sure.
I love Twins. Twins was a fun movie. So
Twins is a fun movie. I don't know if I need to see Triplets. I mean, listen, I'm all for everything. I'm never going to be the guy who thinks that the world is zero sum and that if I'm not super jacked for a movie, it means that other movies that I like aren't getting made. So Triplets, it's fine. Every movie should always come out a million times. So it's like, all right, cool. But I guess, I don't know. I just like, cause like, and from, I haven't seen Genesis, but that's everything I hear is that, like, hey, look, he blows everybody else off the screen. Arnold Schwarzenegger is an icon for a reason. And I just want the world to kind of know that again. Like, I want him to just have, he's got to have one last, just like, this is why Arnold Schwarzenegger is a king kind of moment, right?
Like a Legend of Conan movie.
I mean, that could go really, really well. I mean, I think that kind of the idea of late in life Conan is something that is probably more interesting to me for him as a role than the Terminator movie, to be honest with you.
How old is he now? 60?
Somewhere about 150 years old, I think.
Arnold is 60. He'll be 68.
Wow.
On the 30th.
Can I just say something amazing about Arnold Schwarzenegger that we're back to talking about him in movies, and I just stumbled across the fact that, oh yeah, he was governor for a while too.
Yeah, governor here out in California. I mean, but then again, you know, the
Jerry Brown was his governor.
Exactly. Yeah. You know. and then they reelected Moonbeam. He's named Moonbeam.
Really?
Yeah. Moonbeam. Right, Brown. Yeah.
So what's your pick, Justin?
So we are in to the silly season of politics. I love following it. I talk about it a lot on the Jury Show. So I'm going to give one of my favorite. What do you guys want? Fiction or nonfiction?
Let's go nonfiction.
Yeah,
nonfiction.
Part of Brian and I dumbing it down with our made up rules.
So nonfiction. I'll say. Game Change, Game Change was the first book written about the presidential election 8 years ago. The first one where President Barack Obama was elected. It is a very good read if you are watching the modern electoral picture sort of come into shape, specifically the rise of Barack Obama and how Hillary, who at the time, at this point 8 years ago, was thought to be a slam dunk for the Democratic nomination, became less and less of a slam dunk to the point where she was where she lost. It is well written. It is fascinating. If you watch the HBO version of it, which only focuses pretty much on the Sarah Palin elements, I think that was a very big disservice to the book, because the Sarah Palin stuff, although interesting, is maybe the third most interesting story in that book about some of the stuff that happened during that election, of which there is nothing more fascinating than the human being that is John Edwards and his trials and tribulations. Wow. Just an amazing book. Great reporting. Go ahead and check it out. Game Change.
Cool. I have a plea for people out there. Mm-hmm. If any of you have read my book, Name of the Devil, and liked it and want to put up a review, it's great. That is how you live and die in modern publishing. I mean, if you really liked it, review it. If it wasn't your thing and you don't like devils, then, you know, still don't have to review
or
it.
Names. But, if you're not a name guy.
And right now, like, I'm not supposed to favor one bookseller over another one, but a bookseller that begins with an A. They're selling the paperback version 50% off.
Oh, right on.
Yeah, I got a refund. I got a partial refund on Name of the Devil because I ordered it from the A, and it was on sale from the pre-order, and I got a little money back.
You get the paperback for like $8 and some change right now, which, you know, I don't know how long that'll last, but check that out. The UK version, the ebook, comes out this week, so the UK favors releasing it. So,
Is there an Audible version yet?
Not yet. Working on it.
Okay. Really, really enjoyed the Audible version of the previous Jessica Blackwood book.
So check it out on the A store. I don't know, Andrew's not allowed to talk. I bought my copy on Amazon. If you are looking to get it in the UK, and that is Name of the Devil and Angel Killer in the UK.
Yeah, I think the Angel Killer is coming out the 14th. I'm not sure. I think they might be doing the simultaneous ebook release. So check that out. And again, if you've read Name of the Devil, you liked it, leave a review. Be great.
It should be really,
I mean, you know, throw a little Diamond Club in there. Let people know. Represent. It's always, I love pointing that out to my publisher.
Speaking of which, I had this amazing, moment when I was talking to, Andrew, after driving home. It was like past 11 o'clock, and oftentimes Bonnie's already in bed asleep. And so we're chatting in the car, whatever. He hears me walking into the house or whatever. Uh-huh. And then I see Bonnie's light on. And so I'm like, oh, hey, let me put you on pause, Andrew, for just a moment. And I pause and walk in and catch Bonnie in bed with Andrew Main.
With Andrew Main and his sweet words.
But disguised as a woman.
Yeah. Which only made it more confusing. But it was that was a great moment.
And let me tell you something that was really cool. So I got asked to do this little bookstore signing in out in Brentwood. And I did it the year before. And it's the time of day when nobody I know in LA is able to make it out there because of traffic and all that. And I was hesitant to do it last year. And I reluctantly agreed to do it this year. And it was on the launch day, and I really should have spent here the day doing a Google Hangout or something. But I'm like, all right, I'll go do this to support the bookstore or whatever. And, you know, I pushed it out on social media, did whatever I could do, you know, boing, boing, you know, picked it up, which is great. And so, like, you know, biggest push I could possibly do, email list, whatever.
Yeah.
A handful of people showed up.
Sure.
Every single person was somebody from I knew. Half the people there were all Diamond Clubbers.
Oh, so, wow, that's great.
That's awesome.
Yeah, was that where you got the picture with Simone?
Simone and Andrew showed up. Amazing. We had a cover boy, Justin, showed up. And so, you know, it was really, really good. You know, just it was nice to see that. So, I mean, that warmed me up to feel, you know, to see that. So
listen,
So yeah, that was awesome. That was, and I was somebody like, what is it? Are they fans? I'm like, no, like we're part of the same club, you know? Yeah. It's just, we're a club, you know? It's a sort of this mutual support society kind of thing.
Absolutely.
So. Some might use another C word that rhymes with cult.
Okay. Please. Please be specific about the four-letter C word that you are associating us with.
That begins with C and ends with T.
Yeah, okay. Everybody support the Diamond Club, the Diamond Club projects. And, man, again, name the devil. Like, I can't say enough about it. I got my copy today or this week on launch day in the mail because I pre-ordered it. And I could not be happier to dig back into it because it's been a while since I read it. So everybody check it out.
As soon as I can pull it out of Bonnie's claws, I'll make sure to do that.
I know. She's on her third reading at this point. Probably. She's lapped you.
I mean, again, it's no The Journey, but...
No Chet Page, but... again, listen. I'm saying it's the Justin Robert Young challenge. If you're not into that book after 20 pages, then you're just not gonna be. You're just not into that genre. Because also, that first 20 pages is rad as hell.
Also, no longer friends with Justin Robert Young.
Well, listen. I'm very temperamental about specific guarantees that I make.
All right. Thank you, everybody. We're going to go jump right into After Things after a short break and break down our Comic-Con extensive coverage because we were nowhere near there. But nonetheless, it's been weird.
The Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.